Welcome to Spruce Grove Alliance Church, your home.
Well, we're in this series called Encounters with Jesus, answers to life's biggest questions. And we have been scuba diving. Shall I say, we're slowing down, we're submersing, emerging, exploring these encounters with Jesus, and we are getting to know Jesus in the process. And today, we're going to turn up the brightness of his glory, so to speak, as we reflect on how two grieving sisters encountered the glory of Jesus. And I believe today that my prayer is that he would turn up the light of his glory in our lives. Maybe today the light is like a little pen light for you, the light of his glory in your life. But my prayer is, watch your eyes, is that it gets really bright in your life. All right. Question for you. Have you ever been frustrated because God doesn't meet your expectations? No? Okay, well, this will be easy. We'll be done. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you that we don't have to deal with this and we all have a handle on this. Who are we kidding? Every single one of us have had times in our lives where we have been frustrated because God doesn't meet our expectations, right? Whether they're major or they're minor things, there's seasons in our life, and maybe you're in one of those seasons right now where God isn't meeting your expectations. You're like, come on, God. Are you kidding me? I can remember when we were in seminary, and I went as a full-time student. Eric was working. We didn't have 2 cents. And we were poor. Our kids look back on that as one of the best times of their lives, and we look back on that as one of the times we just had to get through. And I remember we were to the point of washing out Ziploc bags so we can use them for like the third or the fourth time. So we could save $2.63 and not have to buy a brand new bag of Ziploc bags. Maybe you're there now. Maybe you've been there. And then, and our friends, what seemed like all of our friends, it seemed like money just fell from heaven in their lives. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, when I'm washing out Ziploc bags here, like, the frustration with money is a big one, isn't it? Maybe it's frustration with relationships. There's somebody in your life that needs to change. Or there's someone that's causing you deep pain in your life. And you're like, God, come on, and fix the situation. Maybe it's your lot in life. Maybe it's your job. Maybe it was COVID-19. God didn't act the way you think he should throughout that 2 year, whatever that was. You've been frustrated. We've all been frustrated when God doesn't meet our expectations. But all those are minor frustrations compared to the major frustration of losing a loved one before the proper time, right? Whew, got serious, didn't it? Yeah, it's one thing to go to a funeral from someone who's, shall we say, they've lived a quote-unquote full life, but when you have to say goodbye to a loved one before their quote-unquote proper time, that's when you're like, come on, God, are you serious? It calls every question that you have about God to the forefront. When you go to the hospital, they ask you to rate your pain from 1 to 10, 1 being like a hangnail, 10 being like, this is excruciating. And when it comes to losing a loved one before their proper time, that's an 11, spiritually and emotionally, every single time, isn't it? When we were in Bible college, we had to read this book for one of our classes called Lament for Son. It was about a father who lost his son in an accident, and he had to have a funeral for his son, and he wrote this little booklet of his lament. Because that's not how life is supposed to be. The son is supposed to bury the father. The father's not supposed to bury the son, right? And so we were supposed to read this little booklet and then write a 2-page response to this little booklet about pain and suffering and God and how that all fits together. Just a reflective response from this book. And I did the assignment, and I did 2 pages, and I handed it in. Back in the day when you had to hand in actual papers for paper. And I remember one of my fellow students, he did something rather different. And I only know because the professor brought it to class the very next day. He took a clean sheet of paper and put a title page on it like we were supposed to, and then just had one sheet. We were supposed to write 2 pages, and he wrote 4 words at the top. There are no words. And the professor brought it to class the next day because he didn't know if this student was profoundly lazy or profoundly insightful. And he kept talking about it. There are no words to express this frustration in our life of losing a loved one before the proper time. We're going to look today at 2 sisters who experienced that major frustration with Jesus. Some of Jesus' best friends. Like, he had meals with these people. They're his best friends. And their brother dies, and Jesus doesn't fit their expectations. In fact, he delays. He doesn't come on time. For the past few weeks, we have been looking at what is wrong with the world. And today, we are going to consider who can make it right. We're going to turn a corner in the series today, and we're going to talk about who can make it right. And we're going to reflect on these 2 encounters that Jesus had with 2 sisters who had this major frustration of losing a loved one before their proper time. All right, let's just read the first few verses in John chapter 11, and then we'll pause here for a second. It says, "Now a man named Lazarus was sick, and he was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, 'Lord, the one you love is sick.' And when he heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed." Just pause there for a second. Sometimes the love of Jesus for us is he stays. So he stayed where he was for 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews were there and tried to stone you, yet you still are going back?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight?" He obviously hasn't been in Alberta in the winter solstice. But anyway, we'll go with it. "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by the world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." Those 2 verses are key. We'll come back to that. And after he said this, he went on to tell them, "Your friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going to wake him up." Okay. Now, how many of you have ever seen the movie The Matrix, where Morpheus comes to Neo and he says, "Red pill, blue pill. You know, you can take this pill and you can kind of just forget what goes on in the world, and you just kind of have a surface level understanding of what's going on in the world. But if you take this pill, you kind of got to see how far the wormhole goes. I'm going to offer you that pill this morning, and we're just going to just briefly see how far the wormhole goes, so it makes what Jesus does next pop even more. Okay, so Jesus is saying here, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daylight will not stumble, for they will not walk by the world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." What is Jesus doing here with all of this light talk? He is setting the stage for what he's going to do next with Lazarus. I want to back up just for a few seconds, and I want to see the Gospel of John from the 1,000-foot view. The Gospel of John is known as the Book of Signs. You're reading along, and Jesus will do a miracle, and it says, this is Jesus' the first sign. Then he does another miracle. This is Jesus' second sign. It's called the Book of Signs. And there is this metaphor in the book of John, a metaphor of light and darkness. It starts in John and John 1 and continues to John chapter 11. John, by the way, has almost exclusively new information about Jesus that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do not cover. John wants to give a new perspective on Jesus. You see this especially in John chapter 1 when he's talking about the Christmas story. Matthew and Luke, when they talk about Christmas, they get shepherds and wise men and angels and all the pageantry and stuff that's going on in the world. John wants to have this theological, ontological perspective of God coming, man, because in the beginning was the Word. And then he talks about the light shine in the darkness. And so we're introduced to this light in John chapter 1, and it goes all the way to John chapter 11. There are seven signs that Jesus does from chapters 2 to chapter 11. He turns water into wine. That's his first sign. He heals an official's son. He heals a paralytic. He feeds 5,000 people. He walks on water. He heals the blind. And he raises Lazarus from the dead. Okay, preview for Revelation coming in a few years. John, the same writer of this gospel, also wrote the book of Revelation. I'm not going to fight you on that. We'll fight about that later. But he did, okay? I'm right. John wrote the same book, okay? Revelation. The number 7 in the book of Revelation is significantly important. In fact, there are 55 series of sevens in the book of Revelation. I don't have time to get in all of them. 55 series of sevens in the book of Revelation. Seven is an extremely significant number. You go back in the Old Testament, you got 7 days of creation, all that stuff. So he comes to Revelation, there's 55 series of seven. John also wrote this book. The number 7, who knows what the number 7 actually means? Completeness or perfection. Okay? So this is the complete and perfect kingdom of heaven. You want to know what heaven is like? Look at these 7 signs that Jesus does. Water to wine at a wedding. So God saves an abundant of his best for the last. Heals an official's son so there's no sickness, there's no sin, there's no body parts that don't work. There's a feeding of the 5,000. There's abundant provision. There walks on water. Water represents evil in the Bible. There is no evil. He heals a blind man and there is no death. So there's all your body parts work. There's no tears, there's no suffering, there's no fame. That gives you a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven, okay? Now, John chose these signs on purpose. If you go to the very end of his book in John chapter 20, it says this: Jesus performed many other signs which are not recorded in this book. You can go to Matthew, Mark, and Luke and see them and many more beyond that. But he says, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name. Life and light are synonymous in the book of John. So John chose these signs specifically on purpose. They are meant to build in brightness. If you go back to those signs there, he starts with a really small one, turning water into wine. Now, I can't do that, but it's just a small light of his glory. And then it builds and builds. It's like a dimmer switch, 7 settings on a dimmer switch until he puts his glory on full high beams. Oh, there we go. I just blinded you. And he raises Lazarus from the dead. So he starts small, and it builds in crescendo to John chapter 11, to this story that we're going to see today of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. And so what Jesus is saying with this light metaphor, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Who walks by the daylight will not stumble, and those who walk at night will stumble. He's saying this next miracle is going to be my glory on full display. And it is going to be a watershed. It is going to cause 2 things. It is going to cause some people to stumble and some people to not stumble. It is going to cause some people to want to be drawn to the light and accept that light and life in their lives and come to me. And it is going to make some people stumble and is going to make some people want to extinguish this light. And we see that this miracle is known all throughout the Gospels as the miracle that rocket propels Jesus to the cross. The Pharisees want him dead after this. And Lazarus. All right, I let the cat out of the bag, didn't I? He rose Lazarus from the dead. Here we go. Let's read this miracle. Now that we've gone into the matrix, let's come back out and let's read these encounters. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to visit Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, If you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even though they die, will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And after she said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. And Jesus wept. And then the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of a blind man have kept this man from dying? Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. And it was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days. And then Jesus said, didn't I not tell you, if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of people standing here, that they may believe you sent me. When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth around his face. And Jesus said to him, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. And so from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Wow. Two different encounters with Martha and Mary, from two frustrated women who say the exact same thing. Verbatim, they say the exact same thing to Jesus. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But yet Jesus, did you notice that? Had two vastly different responses to them. Like, they said verbatim the exact same thing to him. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus says two different responses to them. Now, husbands can learn a lot of relational wisdom on how to communicate with their wives just by looking at Jesus. How many husbands has this ever happened to you? Your wife is frustrated, and she's telling you about her day, and you're trying to figure out in your mind, does she want me to solve the problem, or does she just want me to empathize and listen, right? And some days, maybe it is to solve the problem. Some days, maybe it is to listen, but most days, I get it wrong. This encounter here, these two responses by Jesus, not only show Jesus' profound relational wisdom, that he sees their hearts, that he sees Martha and he sees Mary's hearts, but more importantly, these two encounters show us the duality of his nature, that Jesus is both fully God and he's fully man. Now, in evangelical theology, we have something called first-tier theology, non-negotiable first-tier theology. There's some theology that we can debate and we can decide to disagree, agree to disagree, but there's some that is non-negotiable, and one is that Jesus is fully God and that he's fully man. And sometimes this theology can be rather abstract and out there, and it's kind of like reading a dictionary. But here in these encounters, we see that this abstract theology becomes really concrete because it puts it in a real life example. These encounters, shall we say, bring to light this theology. To Martha, Jesus shows his divinity, his godness. And to Mary, he shows his humanity. To one, he pushes against the flow of her heart towards despair when she says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." "Well, I am the resurrection and the life. Who believes in me will live even though he dies. I'm going to offer you my divinity." But to the other one, when she says the exact same thing, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died," he enters into that despair. I like what Timothy Keller says in his book, that he offers a ministry of truth and a ministry of tears. To one, he pushes against the flow of her heart towards despair and offers truth. "I'm the resurrection and the life." And to the other one, he enters into it with his own emotions. By the way, what an amazing model for ministry. As we deal with people who have painful frustrations with Jesus, that some days it needs to be a ministry of truth, and some days it needs to be a ministry of tears. Like, do you realize that our community life center is going to provide more opportunities for us to provide this ministry of truth and this ministry of tears to people? That people can come into this place and we can offer them the Jesus who is the way, the truth, and the life, but also enter into their struggle with their tears. I mean, we could put a sign up at the CLC, "Truth and Tears Offered Here." But let's just jump into these encounters briefly. Martha, he offers this ministry of truth, and he says, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die." That is a bold, an outlandish, an audacious claim. Do you understand that? That "I am the resurrection and the life." Do you know what he's saying in that? I'm not a handyman, okay? I am not a carpenter. I am very insecure about that too. I do not like doing home renovations. You can just ask my wife. I told you, like, when I grab a hammer, it's like lightning does not hit the same spot twice. I remember once when I was cutting a board, I was building some shelves in my garage. I put the board on my freezer, and I was using a skill saw, and I was like so excited because I thought, you know, how hard it is to cut a skill saw straight, and I cut this perfectly straight line on this board, and I admired it, and then I looked at what I had done, and there is my freezer handle there. Yeah. So now every time I go to my freezer, there's my glory on full display, reminder of my complete incompetence when it comes to being a carpenter or a handyman, okay? So if you ask me for help when it comes to being like a carpenter or a handyman, I would say prepare to be extremely frustrated because I'm completely useless, almost completely useless like that. But if you would ask me for help on something else that maybe I'm like a 6 out of 10 of, or maybe even on a good day I'm a 7 out of 10 of, or like a broken clock is right twice a day, maybe I'm good at, like maybe preaching and leadership. If you would ask me for help on that, I would never make the bold, audacious, outlandish claim, "Well, of course I can help you with that because I am preaching and leadership. In fact, everything flows from me in this regard. Sermons exist because of me. Leadership principles exist because of me. I empower every sermon that's ever preached and every leadership principle that's ever been crafted. In fact, if you find anything true of sermons or leadership, it's because it existed in me first." Now, if I start talking like that, you probably should step away from me because I'm probably going to get struck by lightning. God. But yet this is the audacious, outlandish claim that Jesus is making about life. Not that I'm a good paramedic or I'm an excellent doctor, but I am the be-all and end-all of life itself. It all flows from me. I am the power that gives everything life and keeps it alive. That is a bold, outlandish claim. And Jesus here makes a promise that goes well beyond what he's going to do for Lazarus. He says, anyone who believes in him will live eternally. Do you know the power of that promise today? That Paul is what Paul talks about from Colossians chapter 1, this Christ in you, the hope of glory, that the light and the life is inside of you, this eternal glory inside of you that's going to live forever. Do you know that promise today? You can. And Jesus further illustrates his divinity by talking about this thing called sleep. He says, Lazarus is asleep. This is where Christians get this whole idea of soul sleep. In fact, the Greek word for cemetery means the place of rest or the place of sleep. He says, I'm going to go wake Lazarus up. Have you ever had fun waking somebody up? Have you? It can be fun and it's easy. Waking somebody up, scaring someone. When we were at Briarcrest in our college days, they had these really early classes, like 7:30 in the morning. Like, it was just stupid early for an 18-year-old that stays up till 2 in the morning. Anyway, you had to go to these early morning classes, and I wasn't there for this, but the story circulated in the college at the time. And so it would be known for some students to kind of nod off in the class. And so in one of these classes, the professor was teaching, and he got the students just to read kind of a chunk of scripture, and then they were going to talk about it. So he just said, read. And so everyone's heads are down, and the professor's head's down. And then somebody fell asleep in class, and his friend decided to have some fun with them. And so everyone's head's down, right, in the reading. And he elbows his friend. He wakes him up, and he said, the professor wants you to close in prayer. And so he stands up. Dear God, thank you for what we've learned today. Help us to apply it to every life. The professor's like, thank you. Have a seat. Oh man, he was embarrassed. But you can have some fun waking people up. And it's really easy. Jesus is saying that raising someone from the dead is as easy as us waking somebody up. It's just like they're asleep. That's his divinity. This is the absolute powerful truth of Jesus' divinity pushing against the flow of Martha's heart. Well, if Martha experienced the divinity of Jesus, the truth, will Mary experience the humanity of Jesus? Tears. He is deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And once more, he is deeply moved and Jesus weeps. Now that phrase there, deeply moved in spirit and troubled, once more deeply moved, I haven't found a theologian that likes that English translation. It's really hard to translate into English. It's that Greek word embrimomia, which means the snort of a horse at war or in a race. It's like that, like they're agitated. It would probably better translated, became angry in spirit and very agitated. And so, like, you have this picture of this war horse that charging into battle, like, or in a race, just wanting to win the race. And so that's kind of the essence of that Greek word. And so to translate it, deeply moved in spirit and troubled, is kind of weak. That most theologians say that it needs to be more of an angry in spirit and very agitated. And Jesus here is entering into the emotion of the moment in his humanity. But what's he angry at? He's not angry at Mary. Not in the least. Hear that. He's not angry at Mary. He's angry at death. He's angry at what the sting of death does to us. See, death was not part of God's original plan for this world from when he created it in Genesis 1. It's the result of sin. And these here are passionate tears of anger against the thing that frustrates us and hurts us the most. And so it says, once more, Jesus, deeply moved, came to the tomb. And John Calvin says here that this is a champion who prepares for a conflict. He approaches the tomb, or you could say he enters the UFC octagon ring. This is the wrath of the Lamb flipping tables. And we should read Jesus and the rest of this encounter with a bit of an edge, where Jesus is not going to play with the pen light anymore. He's not going to turn water into wine. That was so yesterday. Here he's going to turn his glory on full display. He's going to let everyone see the light of his glory. This is the dark nemesis that he came to conquer for his people. This thing called death. And Jesus' words here have this raw, sovereign, passionate, authoritative power. So when it says Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. There's this rawness. There's this snorting to it. There's this warhorse attitude to it, where he's fighting this nemesis that he came here to defeat once and for all. He gets a glimpse of the nemesis that he came here to defeat. Not into water and wine anymore. I'm going to defeat death. I'm going to get a glimpse of it, and I'm going to go after it. Jesus called out in a loud voice, and some say that Jesus needed to specify Lazarus, or all the dead in the area would have been raised. When Jesus' words go out of his mouth, something happens. That's power. My words don't have that much power. In another one of John's famous books in the New Testament, which we already mentioned, Revelation, John illustrates the power of Jesus' words with this thing called a sword. We're introduced to Jesus in John chapter 1 with the sword coming out of his mouth. You can imagine they didn't have like superhero movies back then, or they didn't have graphics and pictures, so they was trying to illustrate the power of Jesus' words. Out of his mouth is coming the sword. And then in Revelation 19, the great parousia, when Jesus comes in a great blaze of glory to defeat his enemies once and for all, there's this sword coming out of his mouth, which he strikes down his enemies. Some of them think that this battle of Armageddon at the end of all time, when he comes in a blaze of glory, is going to be this kind of neck-and-neck battle, this triple overtime, edge of your seat. Who's going to win? Oh, no. Is it going to be God or is it going to be Jesus? Oh, no, no. Ooh-ha. And the crowd goes, oh, no, Jesus, let's hit the post. Oh, and then it goes down the other end of the ice. You're like, oh, no. Oh, Satan almost scored. And you think, oh, no, who's going to win? But nothing could be farther from the truth. If you read this story at the end of all times, the great parousia, when he comes with a sharp sword in his mouth, Jesus shows up to this battle, and we're there dressed in bed sheets just saying, yay, Jesus, go, Jesus. And the enemies of Jesus show up, and Jesus just speaks defeat over his enemies. I win. That's power in your words. The mushroom cloud goes from his mouth, something like, I win. And he defeats his enemies once and for all. With the raw, sovereign, authoritative power that spoke the world into existence in Genesis chapter 1. With the raw, sovereign, authoritative power that calmed the sea and said, peace, be still. With the raw, sovereign, authoritative power that spoke on the cross, it is finished. With the raw, sovereign, authoritative power that will one day finally speak defeat over his enemies once and for all, Jesus pulls the sword from its sheath once, and he speaks in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! And some of you this morning need to hear that raw, authoritative, sovereign voice of Jesus over the thing that you are powerless to the most. You need to let him speak. We sang in the song, With just one word, he can heal what's broken inside. And we like to speak, and we like to fix it with our words. But Jesus' words are so much more powerful against the thing that we are powerless to the most. Some of you this morning need a ministry of truth and tears. You need to encounter Jesus' full divinity and his full humanity in the thing that you are powerless to the most, the thing that is frustrating you the most. It was July 1st, and I only remember that it was July 1st because that night we heard fireworks in the city that we were living in, Moncton, and we could hear them off in the distance, and so I put that two and two together. Before Caleb and Leah were born, our two children, Eric and I were expecting our first child. And we went camping that long weekend, and I think she was about 4 months pregnant. And she wasn't feeling very well. She wasn't feeling very good. So we came home early, and we took her to the hospital, and she got checked out, and everything looked all right. So we came home, and she still wasn't feeling very good. And we were sitting on the couch, and Erica left the room, and she went into the other room. She went to the washroom, and then I heard the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. She says, "I think I had my baby." So we rushed to the hospital, and sure enough, it was true. And so we come home, and we're sitting in our apartment as the sun goes down, and it's dark outside, and the lights are off in our apartment, and we're sitting in on our sofa, and we're holding each other. And I remember this contrast because I could hear the fireworks going off in the distance as people were celebrating Canada Day. And it felt like the whole world was celebrating while we were in pain. The whole world was celebrating in light and flashing of light, and we were in darkness, right? It's moments like that where I need to know the God of truth and the God of tears. It's moments like that where I need to know that Jesus is snorting mad. That he's snorting mad at the thing that frustrates me the most, that causes me the most pain in life, and that he is able to do something about it. And he does. You see, the only way to interrupt Lazarus' funeral is to summon his own. The only way that he's going to save us from death is if he dies and he overcomes the grave himself, and he does. That by believing you might have life in his name. That is the God of truth, and that is the God of tears. I'm asking the worship team to come. Where do you need to encounter the God of truth and tears this morning? What situation do you feel powerless in your frustration? What minor frustration or a major frustration? Maybe for you it's money, maybe it's a relationship, maybe it's some lot in life, maybe it's your job. Where's God not meeting your expectations? Or maybe it's a major frustration. Maybe it's facing this whole thing called death and eternal life. Where do you feel powerless in your frustration? Where do you need to let Jesus' raw, authoritative, sovereign voice, his divinity and his humanity, speak into your situation? It's interesting that both Martha and both Mary, they went out to meet him. She got up quickly and went to him. They both bring their frustration to Jesus. It's a beautiful thing.
Thanks for listening to this week's message from Spruce Grove Alliance Church. For more information or to hear past messages, please visit sgac.net.